the UK government in turmoil as the incoming finance minister announces plans to revise the controversial tax policy of his predecessor. Tensions escalating in the West Bank, where Israeli forces have killed three Palestinians in a single day. And in Turkey, a huge mine explosion leaves dozens of workers dead. Welcome to World News from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Britain's new finance minister, Jeremy Hunt, is signalling a U-turn on an unpopular economic plan Prime Minister Liz Truss unveiled after taking office last month.
It was a mistake to cut the top rate of tax at a period when we were asking everyone to make sacrifices. And it was a mistake to fly blind and not to back up the economic plans that were announced with an independent forecast from the Office for Budget Responsibility.
Hunt acknowledged that tax increases were on the cards, but he added what Britons want more than anything else is stability, including the political one. He said he needs to deliver on those expectations. Truss fired Kwasi Kwarteng as her Chancellor of the Exchequer on Friday. She also scrapped parts of her economic package that caused uproar, even in the ruling Conservative Party itself. Hunt is due to announce the government's medium-term budget plan on October 31st. It will be a key test of his ability to show investors that the UK can restore its economic credibility. The country is grappling with high inflation and slow economic growth that has raised the fears of a recession. Our London correspondent Robert Carter says a U-turn on her tax plan was an embarrassment for Prime Minister Liz Truss in just 2 months in office.
Major economic crisis that has been brought about just weeks. In fact, I think it's under 2 months since the new Prime Minister came into office. Now, this Prime Minister, Liz Truss, won her battle in the Tory leadership campaign on the back of promises that she was going to implement tax cuts, was going to fix the economic crises that have plagued Britain's economy for the past several years, and that's what eventually won her fight. But what's happened in the space of a couple of weeks is that she's managed to perform a deeply embarrassing and humiliating U-turn, sacked her chancellor, her former chancellor, who had only been in the role alongside her for a matter of weeks, and has totally backpedaled on all of the policies that won her the right to become the current prime minister. Now she's turned in her desperation to a seemingly safe and trusted pair of hands, a brand that has some credibility, Jeremy Hunt, who has performed many roles for several previous governments. And clearly, Jeremy Hunt has informed the prime minister that, look, I will take the job on, but there's going to be major changes, and I'm going to have to implement my views on what should happen going forward. Truss has totally accepted that clearly, and Mr. Hunt has even admitted that past mistakes are going to have to be cleared up. This is tremendously embarrassing.
A damning report shows the EU Border and Coast Guard agency Frontex was involved in human rights violations and tried to cover them up. The agency's efforts to force refugees away from EU borders at sea resulted in thousands of deaths. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
It's estimated at least 2,000 refugees drowned in the Aegean Sea during 2020 as they were pushed back from the EU coastline by Frontex, the 27-nation bloc's border and coast guard agency. Frontex prevented at least 40,000 asylum seekers from reaching the EU, which blatantly breaks international law. A report by OLAF, the EU's anti-fraud office, concludes Frontex has been systematically involved in human rights abuses. The scandal was raised by reporters on Thursday following a meeting of EU Justice and Home Affairs ministers.
My colleague Ylva Johansson in the Home Affairs Council is in charge of such a kind of issue, and certainly Frontex. So if you have the opportunity to ask the same question to Ylva Johansson, she will have maybe the possibility to answer to you.
This is the end of the press conference.
However, on Friday, EU Home Affairs Commissioner Ylva Johansson only took three unrelated questions from journalists, despite many lining up to ask about the Frontex scandal.
According to the Olaf report, Frontex top management not only ignored indications of human rights violations, they were also complicit. Former head of Frontex, Fabrice Légeries, and his team gave instructions to look the other way so as not to witness pushbacks. In addition, they covered up the illegal practices of Greek border officials. Légeries resigned last April after parts of the Frontex scandal first came to light. The EU pays outside countries billions of euro to stop refugees from travelling to the bloc. Apparently, this practice contributes to the rights abuses. To compound the injustice, EU ministers have pledged to expand support measures to 4 million Ukrainian refugees who have arrived in the bloc and insist there is no limit on the number who can still travel here. The GUE-NGL group of EU lawmakers, known as the Left, is demanding that a debate on the Frontex scandal is held in the European Parliament next week. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Israeli forces have killed 3 Palestinians in a single day in the occupied West Bank. Troops killed a Palestinian man late on Friday over a shooting attack at a settlement near the city of Ramallah. They arrested another Palestinian in connection with that incident, which left an Israeli settler wounded. Earlier on Friday, Israeli troops attacked the Jenin refugee camp, killing 2 further Palestinians. One of them was a doctor who was shot while attending to the injured. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed so far this year in the occupied territories, most of them since March. That's when the regime launched an ongoing crackdown following a series of deadly attacks by Palestinians against Israelis. Resistance groups say the attacks are in response to the Israeli atrocities. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, says Palestinians are pressing ahead with their armed resistance against Israel in response to the regime's crimes and a land grab policy.
Palestinians every day are doing their utmost to prove to the Israeli forces, of course, according to the different political powers and experts, they are doing their utmost to prove that despite the Israeli aggression, illegal policies, the atrocities, the crimes being committed against the Palestinians. However, Palestinians are still adherent to the choice of resistance. And now we are speaking about armed resistance. It's not only about taking part in protests and demonstrations. However, Palestinians are also being engaged in armed resistance to tell the Israelis that they are occupiers and that the Israeli occupation must come to an end. Yesterday alone, 3 Palestinians were killed in the occupied West Bank, 2 of them during a raid to Jenin refugee camp, northern the occupied West Bank, and a 3rd Palestinian had succumbed to his injuries he sustained last month in an operation in the Jordan Valley. The 17-year-old Palestinian was originally from Jenin.
Iran's leader says the Muslim world can claim its rightful place in global geopolitics through unity and overcoming the temptations of enemies, especially the US and Israel. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said to have unity, Muslims should work together to preserve their common interests and thwart the plots of arrogant powers. The leader also noted that the differences between the 2 major branches of Islam should not lead to disputes among Muslims. He said there are extremists among both Sunnis and Shias, but have nothing to do with either. The leader stressed that those who inflame the sentiments of one faith in the name of support for another should be seriously confronted. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, the enemies have been seeking to drive a wedge among Muslims by creating and empowering Israel. He warned that divergence among Muslim nations has paved the way for intensified crackdowns and atrocities against people in Palestine and other Islamic countries. The leader also described the normalization of ties between some Muslim countries and the Israeli regime as one of the biggest acts of betrayal. He stressed, however, that unity is still possible among Muslim nations through hard work and perseverance in the face of difficulties. Ayatollah Khamenei cited the example of the Islamic Republic of Iran, saying it stood up to former world powers, the United States and the Soviet Union, when it was a sapling. The leader said now that the Islamic Republic has turned into a mighty tree, no one should even consider uprooting it. Ayatollah Khamenei was speaking at a meeting with the participants in the Islamic Unity Conference, which was held in Tehran in recent days. Masood Shajara is with the Islamic Human Rights Commission. He says unity among Muslims is the only way to thwart U.S. plots.
It really is now very clear for everyone to see that what has come in the last years as a result of policy of United States and Western world, in not just in the region of Middle East, but everywhere else. I mean, look, it's very easy. Just look at Afghanistan, look at Iraq, look at Syria, look at Libya. You see that there is a destruction, total destruction of the civil society, destruction of the infrastructure, and what they have replaced it with is really chaotic and sort of an environment where it's not fit for ordinary human beings to live. The solution is that the Muslims to come together. Muslims, in reality, are on receiving end of all these oppression, and they need to unite and they need to stand.
The Iranian foreign minister has criticized Western double standards in condemning Iran's response to the recent riots in the country. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the EU never gives such a response to similar events in Western countries. He is urging European officials to adopt a realistic approach to the issue. Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. The top Iranian diplomat added that the Islamic Republic enjoys strong popular support and an efficient democracy. He stressed that Iran is not a land of velvet and color coups. In turn, Borrell assured Amir Abdullahian that the EU does not wish to interfere in Iran's internal affairs. Some EU officials have criticized Iran for its response to the unrest, threatening sanctions. Iran has warned of retaliatory measures in case of such a move. A top court in Argentina allows the remaining crew members of a Venezuelan cargo plane to leave the country after they were prohibited to depart since June. The five people include two Venezuelan and three Iranian nationals. They are among 19 crew members of a Boeing 747 cargo plane that was grounded in Argentina over illegal U.S. sanctions. The plane had been sold by Iranian company Mahan Air to Venezuelan airliner Imetrasur, both sanctioned by the U.S. The aircraft carrying auto parts landed in the Argentinian capital en route from Mexico on June 6th. It was not permitted to refuel in Buenos Aires airport, so it headed for Uruguay, where it was denied entry. That forced the plane to fly back to Argentina, where its crew were detained at the request of the United States. Argentina later freed 14 crew members. The death toll from Friday's coal mine blast in northern Turkey rises to 40 as rescuers are trying to find one more missing miner. The Interior Ministry earlier said 58 miners were able to come out unharmed. It said miners and rescue teams made great sacrifices to free those trapped. Some 110 people had been working underground when a methane blast rocked the mine located in the Black Sea town of Amasra. According to the Health Ministry, 11 of those pulled out alive are being treated in hospital. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is set to fly to the accident site. It was one of the deadliest industrial accidents in years in Turkey. U.S. President Joe Biden has delivered his national security strategy. He has again pointed to China as the biggest threat to U.S. security and the world order. That being the case, the question would be, why does the U.S. take a militaristic approach to contain China, threatening global peace and stability in the process?
The rising rivalries between the U.S. and China are set to dominate the coming years in the 21st century. That is because the U.S. has unveiled its long-delayed national security strategy, where China is named as the most consequential geopolitical challenge for the regime in Washington. That means that Washington is prioritizing winning over China, as Beijing is seen as the only global rival to the U.S. Jake Sullivan, the U.S. National Security Advisor, said, "The People's Republic of China harbors the intention and increasingly the capacity to reshape the international order in favor of one that tilts the global playing field to its benefit." The U.S. strategy further insists that China represents the most consequential challenge to the global order. It also says the U.S. must win the economic arms race with the superpower if it hopes to retain its global influence. The strategy has warned that China's rapid advances in technology is aimed at molding the world order. The strategy is in line with the rhetoric pursued by the Biden administration and its predecessor. Biden officials have accused Russia and China of looking to change the so-called rules-based order.
When it comes to the U.S.-China relationship, the two have clashed on a variety of issues, but most of it, not all, have been initiated by Washington. The two countries have faced off over trade, Beijing's claims to the South China Sea, Taiwan, and technology, among others, and the U.S. has made it clear that it will not let China succeed in any of those areas.
The term has come to be seen as a synonym for Washington-led world order. The Biden administration has entangled itself in a number of global crises, including the war in Ukraine. The Washington regime encouraged the war in Ukraine by sending more weapons into the conflict zone. Washington is using the crisis to contain Russia. And by encouraging its allies to sever their energy ties with Moscow, Washington is trying to push European countries into its own sphere of influence. Furthermore, Washington is stoking tensions in the East Asia region by strengthening its ties with the Chinese Taipei. Back in August 2022, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan, drawing an angry reaction from China. Beijing has warned that it will not tolerate Washington's meddlesome interference in its own affairs. But Washington's increasingly belligerent behavior in Europe and East Asia has pushed Russia and China closer together. They have forged closer ties in a variety of fields, including energy, business, and defense areas. Furthermore, both Moscow and Beijing are key members of the BRICS groups of countries and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Two bodies are playing key roles in shifting the Western-led balance toward a multipolar world. Russia and China have also forged closer ties with countries like Iran and India, which are emerging powers in the shifting geostrategic relations worldwide. It is now widely believed that Washington's ambitions to still lead the world is facing tough challenges. It appears that the regime in Washington has no longer the capability that it once possessed to dictate its hegemony.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. Someone who folds their arms instead of undertaking their duties, obligations and responsibilities, instead of using their own abilities, and instead expect Allah to work a miracle on their behalf, such a person should know that the Quran utterly rejects this attitude. Allah delivers a harsh rebuke to the Israelites who told Musa, Go ahead, you and your Lord, and fight. We will be sitting right here. Surah 5, verse 24. In other words, you go and fight our enemies and let us know when you've won. Then we'll come. The Quran rejects this utterly. This approach is that of the Israelites, whom Allah cursed and denied the joys of faith. This is not worthy of someone who claims to submit to Allah. This is not the meaning of trusting in Allah, this idea that has gained currency amongst people. I'm saying this so everyone will hear and understand. This idea people have in which they say, Allah needs to fix this, no one can do anything about this. This is an error. If no one could do anything, if no one had it in them to fight corruption and make the world better, then Allah would not have sent prophets. He would not have summoned people to follow the prophets. He would not have given the prophets weighty messages to deliver to this world. Well, we see that Allah has sent people to fight corruption and make the world better, and we see that they are human beings. Therefore, you should know that it is up to human beings to fight human corruption. So then what does it mean to place one's trust in Allah?
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Tawakkul means that in every situation you rely on Allah and place your hopes in Him. Notice that the definition I am giving here, to rely on Allah and place your hopes in Him in every situation, makes trusting in Allah a basis for action rather than an obstacle to it, and a source of motivation rather than a source for indifference. Have you seen how when some people face difficulties in life, when they go through hardship and they exhaust every visible means at their disposal to rectify their situation without success, what do? Have you seen or heard this? They will do one of a few things. Either they will surrender, when nothing they do seems to work, or they will resign themselves to fate, or they will take the path of least resistance. They won't give up, but in practice they will do whatever is easiest. They won't make any effort to change the circumstances and go wherever life takes them. But even if this person has not visibly surrendered like in the first case, inwardly their mentality is the same. So this is one response people have when they face hardships.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
After the death of Queen Elizabeth, there have been increasing calls for Britain to return some of its loot from former colonies. For instance, South Africans are demanding the return of the country's diamonds that are now adorning the British crown jewels. A South African reacting to the death of Queen Elizabeth said Britain must give back all what it plundered from his country.
You know, and as an African, as someone that was colonized by the British, you know, we don't feel the way the rest of the world feel. In fact, the British people must give our land back, our diamonds back, our heritage. And that's something that we will always ask for.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are discussing reactions in Africa following the death of Queen Elizabeth, including demands for return of what Britain looted during the colonial era in the continent. We shall also be highlighting the humiliation of African leaders in London during the funeral of the British monarch. The second part of our program is on plans by the United States to counter Russia in Africa and the opposition of African leaders to this malicious objective. Stay with us as our experts give us their incisive analysis on today's subjects.
UK's plundering and humiliation of Africa. Calls have grown in South Africa following the death of Britain's Queen Elizabeth II for the return of a stunning gem stolen from the country. South Africans are demanding the return of the Great Star of Africa, which is kept with other jewels in the Tower of London. This South African diamond is the largest known clear-cut diamond in the whole world and sits on the end of one of the Queen's scepters. It's known as the Great Star of Africa and was part of a larger diamond which was looted from South Africa and handed to the royal family while it was under British rule in 1905.
Due to the plunder of their country by Britain during colonial rule and the continued humiliation of African leaders, many South Africans refused to mourn Queen Elizabeth. The leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, Julius Malema, was among those who categorically refused to mourn the British monarch.
It will be wrong of me to leave this mic without saying to Britain and everybody else who care, we do not mourn the death of a colonizer and a murderer who came and killed our people, and she's wearing proudly a stolen goods on her head. We have nothing to do.
To discuss more on Britain's looting of Africa and the recent humiliation of African leaders during the funeral of Queen Elizabeth, we have contacted Tshieto Magama, a former member of South African Parliament. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, what's your take on the demands by South Africans that Britain must return the diamonds stolen from the country?
African colonies in particular, but colonies in the global south, by European countries, in particular Britain in this case, but also France and Portugal and Germany, that colonialism and imperialism was brutal. And largely it, of course, focused not only on stealing people from our continent, but also stealing the resources of our continent. And so returning, you know, the stolen goods is perhaps the least that that Britain can do. I mean, if you look at the crown of the British Queen Elizabeth, there is a famous diamond right in the center. It's a huge diamond of over 3,000 carats, you know, and that diamond was taken out in Pretoria. It's called the Cullinan Diamond, and of course was sent to Britain. And it then found its way into the crown of Elizabeth. And so it's absolutely crucial for us, especially Africans in general, but also, of course, other people in the global south who were victims of colonialism, especially European colonialism, that Europe does the right thing, and in this case, particular Britain does the right thing, and at least return the stolen goods.
The death of Queen Elizabeth evoked memories of Britain's brutal colonial past in Africa and all countries that were colonized by Western powers. A Kenyan political analyst, Patrick Gathara, gives his take here on the refusal by many in Africa to mourn Queen Elizabeth.
There's a tendency by some to sort of say, well, the past is the past, just ignore it. It's a nice old lady who has passed. But I'm also encouraged by the fact that there's quite, especially online, quite a vocal a number of people who are refusing to be taken in by this. We're insisting that, no, the history has to be told as it is. We've got to remember it as it is. And especially now, when all these tributes are flowing, when all the when the fundamentals of that history are being laid down, that we don't accept to be erased any longer, that our stories have to be included in there, the good along with the bad.
The resolute anti-colonial stance by young people in Africa is seen as sending a message to the British government and other colonial powers that they will not be absolved from their crimes.
No, well, the message must be clear, you know, to the British Parliament, but also to other former colonizers of Africans, that Africans will not brook that kind of behavior anymore, that Europe, you know, and European countries, and Britain in this case, is not absolved from its historic crimes and atrocities and theft that and plunder, of course, of the African continent, and that Africans have reached a point where they demand, you know, restoration of what was taken, both in terms of blood and treasure from the African continent. And so the reaction of our people on the continent was quite predictable because our people are tired of colonialism and, of course, its contemporary offspring, neocolonialism, which, of course, still subjugates the African continent to the whims and whims of the imperialist North. Of course, today it finds expression in various ways. And it's really a rejection, a visceral rejection of the African people of European colonialism.
Britain colonized and plundered Africa, and London still continues to humiliate Africans and their leaders.
The most recent instance is when African leaders attended the funeral of Queen Elizabeth. They were moved around in a bus while other world leaders, including the US president, arrived in their official cars. Now, many Africans have expressed total displeasure with the way their leaders were humiliated in London. Now, what does this say about Britain's attitude towards other countries and especially African countries?
Look, Britain hasn't changed, not a bit. But it's also a reflection on our leaders in this continent, because as you would have seen on social media and elsewhere, Africans reacted to our leaders attending the funeral of the British Queen, you know, Elizabeth, and many were saying, "Look, those leaders do not represent us. Yes, they occupy the offices of prime ministers and presidents, but they do not represent us." And so the behavior of the British in really, you know, humiliating African leaders really is just a repetition, you know, or at least it's in conformity with how they have always treated Africans.
Well, to add on to that, many in Africa are saying that African leaders should not have attended the funeral of Queen Elizabeth II. Do you agree?
These neo-colonialists and imperialists clearly are unreformed and unreformable. And so the African continent, you know, will have to take its own destiny in its own hands and take responsibility for the decisions that it takes. But it was indeed an extremely disappointing, you know, act by our leaders in the first place to attend the funeral of a woman who has never apologized on behalf of the monarchy for all the atrocities and plunder of the African continent. In fact, you will note that when she ascended to the throne, there were still many colonies under her reign as African queen. She never saw it fit to apologize to an African. And so the behavior of the new British King Charles III that we saw when he even refused to shake the hands, of a person of African descent, of a black person who was in the long line, in the throngs of people that were there, is a clear indication of the absolute racism, of the British monarchy, and of course the system that he represents, which of course is a British and European domination of peoples in the global south.
In March this year, Britain's Prince William and his wife Kate visited Caribbean countries where they were met by activists demanding reparations for slavery amid growing scrutiny of the British Empire's colonial legacy.
60 years of independence, we have not forgotten, and we demand an apology and reparations.
There have been calls for reparations following the atrocities committed by Britain against Africans during the slave trade and the colonial era. Now, do you think the death of Queen Elizabeth will increase these calls?
Well, I certainly hope so. In fact, we have seen this movement, a build-up over the past 10 to 15 years or so, where Africans are indeed making that call for reparations. This culminated, for instance, in the Germans, agreeing to pay reparations to Namibia for the horrible genocide they committed of the Herero people, where they wiped out about almost 75% of the Herero population. And so, definitely there is that movement, calling for reparations. Now, it's a different matter altogether if the West, in broadly, but Britain in this case in particular.
Well, indeed, African nations need to continue demanding reparations for crimes and atrocities committed by colonial powers, especially Britain. I'd like to thank our guest today, Mr. Tshetso Magama, a former member of South African Parliament, for his incisive analysis. We'll now take a short break before our next topic, which is on opposition to U.S. attempts to impose sanctions on African countries trading with Russia. Stay with us.
Africa opposes U.S. sanctions on Russia. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has warned U.S. President Joe Biden over a piece of legislation that has passed through the U.S. House of Representatives, which will require a strategy to counter Russia's role in Africa. Ramaphosa made the remarks during a meeting with Biden in Washington last September, where he defended South Africa neutrality.
The legislation, called the Countering Malign Russian Activities in Africa Act, has yet to clear the U.S. Senate. If passed, the legislation is expected to have repercussions for African countries.
Addressing a meeting with the U.S. Congress Black Caucus in Washington, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa voiced opposition to the U.S. bill that seeks to act against African countries that support Russian activities on the continent.
We are therefore concerned about the possible implications for the African continent if the Countering Malign Russia Activities Bill were to become a U.S. law. The law could have the unintended consequence of punishing the African continent for efforts to advance development and growth. Both the U.S. and Russia are strategic partners for South Africa. As a sovereign country that pursues an independent foreign policy, the bill could punish those who hold independent views.
Now, for more on attempts by the United States to stop the rapidly improving ties between Russia and Africa, we have contacted Nefta Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, as we have there, President Ramaphosa has warned the U.S. against punishing African nations for maintaining ties with Russia. Now, he firmly told Biden that South Africa should not be told by anyone who to associate with. What's your opinion on this stance by President Ramaphosa?
Well, first, I think the statement by President of South Africa, Ramaphosa, is a reflection of also the solidification of African leadership to take a stand against intimidation, the customary Western intimidation. So it also follows after the African countries took a vote. Their vote in the United Nations was not to condemn the Russians as the United States, Russia as the United States was urging it. So this is kind of a development of what you're seeing for the first time in a while of the African countries.
Now, do you think the statement by Ramaphosa will compel the U.S. to reconsider its policy of forcing African countries to downgrade ties with Russia?
So I don't see it changing the position of the United States, them rethinking anything. I think it's one of a series of moves that's indicating the multipolarism that's happened emerging in the world, and that the leadership of different countries and even the people, really the people of different countries and following suit of their population, is not standing for the unilateralism that comes with U.S. and Western European neoliberal order. But the West is committed to that. And I think as a capitalist system, as a capitalist economy sustained and dependent on the super exploitation of the world, they really have no other choice but to continue on the track that they're going. So I don't think Ramaphosa's statement or anything really is going to change the mind of the West.
Kenyan President William Ruto has said his country would consider buying Russian oil to deal with skyrocketing fuel prices in his country. This statement is seen as a signal of simmering African resistance to U.S. sanctions on Russia.
As we mentioned before, there is a resistance to it. The West has been trying to convince the rest of the world that the economic dire situation in terms of access to wheat, access to oil, and these things are the fault of the Russians, but they're the fault of sanctions. And it's clear for anybody to see, and that people are really suffering as a result. We've seen a global crisis as a result of U.S. insistence on continuing its proxy war against Russia through Ukraine, and people are, you know, people are fed up with that, and even the leadership of countries.
Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov, in a speech at the UN General Assembly, cited that the Western sanctions imposed on Russia prevented the supply of grain as well as fertilizers to the poor of Africa.
the impediments by U.S. and EU, the financial and logistical impediments against our grain and fertilizers, have not been lifted. Furthermore, for several weeks, we have been saying that about 300,000 tons of fertilizer are being held up in European ports, and we have been proposing that they be forwarded free of charge to the country, to the needy countries in Africa. But the European Union is not heeding this.
The UN has failed to take decisive action to counter oppressive unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States against countries such as Iran and Cuba. Therefore, the UN, with its current structure, is unlikely to challenge US sanctions against Russia that will certainly lead to loss of lives in Africa.
Unfortunately, the United Nations is still pretty much the way it's structured, with the Security Council being the most powerful entity within it, and still it being dominated by Western agenda, that it's very unlikely that the United Nations as a body will be in a position to do anything against the unilateral U.S. sanctions. They haven't been able to do anything against unilateral sanctions against other countries.
African countries have been calling for the urgent need to reform the United Nations to prevent countries such as the U.S. from misusing this organization, especially the Security Council. In his address to the UN General Assembly last September, the President of Malawi, Lazarus Chakwera, slammed the politicization of human suffering.
But if we are truly one UN family, then leaving no one behind has to be practiced, not just preached. If we are truly one UN family, we must reject any attempts to politicize human suffering by lobbying us to refuse the help of those some find politically offensive. If we are truly one UN family, we must get out of political posturing and welcome more helping hands in resolving the problems the permanent UN Security Council members have sometimes created and which they have failed to solve alone, namely the failure to stop environmental degradation, the failure to prevent unjust wars, the failure to lift unsustainable debt burdens, the failure to prevent food insecurity, and the failure to contain pandemics.
Now, after Russia started its military operation in Ukraine in February, the United States and European governments have been forcing African countries not to support Moscow. Some African countries have defied the West and openly supported Russia, while many have taken an unaligned position. Now, what is the future of African ties with the West and Russia, and will the continent be able to emerge as a truly non-aligned region?
I think what has to happen in Africa, we're seeing promising positions taken by African leaders against Western imperialism. But the problem is they still have their own class interests. They still have too much invested in Western imperialism. And so what really has to happen in Africa is where there be their emergence of people-centered movements, participatory democracy, transformation of the governments and neocolonialism to socialist governments. There has to be that something that's responsive, not only responsive to the people, but of the people themselves. And if we have that, then we can see that any type of relationships in the world that Africa has, the African countries have with Russia or with China or whatever, will be set in the best interest of the African people. Right now, those relationships are dependent on the comprador class, which has been nurtured and is sustained by Western imperialism.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up today. Our guest there says ties between Africa and Russia are based on mutual friendship, unlike Western countries that impose their will on African nations. I'd like to thank Mr. Nefra Freeman for his insight today. And that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is a dear friend and esteemed guest, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you, and of course, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. The question today, dear Sheikh, is about an act that many Muslims have taken to doing, many Shia Muslims especially, and that is doing good deeds on behalf of Sahib al-Zaman, the Imam al-Mahdi, ajalahu ta'ala farjahu sharif. And today I would like to talk about donating, doing charity on behalf of the Imam. What is the meaning of this? Normally, when we pay charity, it is either to do daf'a bala. We want to protect ourselves, our families, from any potential harm and danger by giving a sadaqah. That's the whole idea of doing a sadaqah. And also to get some thawab. So why are we doing the same thing for the Imam, who is an infallible, he's a ma'asum, he is the closest one of us to God? He doesn't really need our charity now, does he, dear Sheikh? So why then are we doing charity on behalf of the Imam?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know that paying charity in behalf of Imam al-Mahdi for the sake of protection of him and sometimes praying for the safeguard of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salatu wassalam. We have plenty of narrations of Ahlul Bayt in this regard. And in different supplications and the, you know, let's say prayers for Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salatu wassalam, the last savior of humanity, we have many, you know, emphasis and encouragement for the people to have this kind of charity and prayer for the, reappearance of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salatu wassalam, and for the safeguard of Imam al-Mahdi from all evil actions and all, you know, transgressors. For example, in one supplication of him, we have that Allahumma a'idhu min sharri kulli baghin wa tagh. O Allah, protect him from all transgressors, from all evildoers. وَمِن شَرَّ جَمِيعِ خَلْقِكِ وَاحْفَظْهُ مِن بَيْنِ يَدَيْهِ وَمِن خَلْفِهِ. O Allah, protect him from all evil people who want to hurt Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salatu wasalam, and protect him from, and, you know, from all sides of Imam al-Mahdi, and, you know, safeguarding from enriching any danger and evil to him.
These are prayers and salutations that we have been ordered to recite, right?
To recite, yes, for the safeguard of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salatu wassalam. وَحْرُسْهُ وَمْنَأْهُ مِنْ أَنْ يُوصَلَ إِلَيْهِ بِسُّ. So protect him from reaching any kind of, you know, danger to him. So you can easily understand that from these supplications that still Imam al-Mahdi, there is a possibility and potentiality of reaching some danger to him, right, from transgressors.
Well, then okay, he wouldn't have been hidden if everything was safe.
Exactly, exactly. Maybe one of the main philosophies of the occultation of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salatu wasalam is feeling danger from some transgressor and evildoers.
Right.
And because many people still, we can understand that many people, they cannot stand Imam al-Mahdi and his justice, okay?
Of course.
And because of that, they want to threaten his life and to, you know, injure this great personality and divine Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salatu wassalam. وَانْصُرْ نَاصِرِهُ وَخْضُ الْخَاذِلِهُ. O Allah, support those people who want to support Imam al-Mahdi, and to, you know, disgrace those people who want to hurt him. وَقْسِمْ بِهِ جَبَابِرَةَ الْكُفْرِ. Those people who are the kind of leaders of the transgressors, okay, evildoers. Some people who are جَبَابِرَةَ الْكُفْرِ. They are leaders of the unbelief. They
right.
are head of the injustice. Those people,
leaders.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Those people who want to cause, hurt for Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salatu wassalam. وَقْتُلْ بِهِ الْكُفَّارَ وَالْمُنَافِقِينَ وَجَمِيعَ الْمُلْحِدِينَ. Those unbelievers, hypocrites, okay, and those transgressors who want to fight Imam al-Mahdi, oh Allah, safeguard him. وَأَدْهِرْ بِهِ الْأَرْضَ عَدْلًا. Because of him, spread justice all over the world.
Right.
Okay. So I think we can easily understand that why we pay charity on behalf of Imam al-Mahdi.
It's for these purposes, right?
Yes. Why we want to, you know, pray for the, you know, reappearance of Imam al-Mahdi and the safeguarding of him, because of these dangers that are, you know, all around him.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Dear Sheikh, some might say that we today in this age, we have countries now, whole communities of Shia Muslims, like in Iran, in Iraq, Lebanon, in Syria, Shia communities who say that they are able to, or we believe we are able to protect the Imam from any harm and any danger. We have armies, weapons,